Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 3rd of May, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, Mike Robinson. We're delighted to be joined today by Alex Thompson, giving us Eastern approaches from the Netherlands. But also we've got a live report from Patrick Henningsen, who is still in Damascus. So we've a lot to cover. We'll get straight on to the news.
Yes, Alex, we'll begin with you. What is the situation in the Netherlands with regards to parliamentary discussions of Syria? It seems pretty sparsely populated there.
Not much we can do about that at the moment, but I hope I'm audible. This is a Dutch parliamentary debate, in fact, with Prime Minister Mark Rutte being caused to answer questions. And various parties sent at least one member of parliament to ask him about Syria. Now, the Netherlands is not directly involved in the carnage in Syria in the way that Britain and America and some other European countries are, although, of course, they do handsomely fund the White Helmet. So, in fact, they're funding al-Nusra Front in that regard. But look at the sparseness of the chamber. There's 150 seats, and you can see as many of the beautiful empty seat backs with their gold seals there as you can in the green upholstery of the House of Commons when politically or financially important debates happen. You know, so most of them have gone off somewhere else.
Alex, as you say, it's not so different from what goes on in the House of Commons.
No, it isn't. But this new parliament, particularly the members of the Forum for Democracy, the three MPs who've been elected from that party, are shaking things up. So they have 2% of the seats now, and they've come out of nowhere to do that. And every time they speak, whether it's the young sharp guy, Thierry Baudet, or the old well-spoken lawyer, what they come out with is just streets ahead of any other politician. So they're having to watch out. And in many debates, they say, why are we not going down the British route and leaving the European Union?
Well, as Brian mentioned, we're also joined by Patrick Henningsen, who is in Syria at the moment. And so by way of an introduction, Patrick is there producing a host of articles and video clips. By way of introduction, let's have a look at one of those video clips, and then we'll ask Patrick for comment on it.
So, again, another school. This is in another part of East Aleppo. This was fully occupied by terrorist factions, and once again, this was an al-Nusra command center, this school. So we told you that many of these schools and institutions are occupied, hospitals, schools, by terrorists throughout the conflict, and the reason is to avoid any reprisals from the Syrian Arab Army or the government or anyone trying to liberate these areas from these occupations. And that's exactly what's happened. This one's been pretty well sanitized over the last couple of months, but you can see there's various quarters, sleeping quarters. There's even a reception room. Lord only knows what this one was for, but you know, a little bit of posh interior decorating by al-Nusra Front here. Maybe this was for special VIPs, perhaps. We're not sure, but...
Patrick, what are your impressions? You've been there for a couple of weeks now.
Yeah, impressions overall of Syria. The impressions are that this is a very large country. A very diverse country, ethnically, religiously, extremely diverse, and so the war front is equally as diverse. So what you have essentially here is this country is one giant war zone, and the government is fighting on, you know, maybe 12, 13, 14 different fronts, maybe more, 20 different fronts, you could say, in total, maybe more than that. So imagine having to deal with that plus incursions from foreign countries on the northern front, from the likes of Turkey, for instance, and the United States, and also on the southern front, the Jordanian border. And we still have a lot of weapons and activity over the in the Golan Heights region with Israel, backwards and forwards as well. Plus, you've got to patrol the skies and secure the air. So, and you have Idlib, which is the second Islamic state, which has been established, essentially a de facto Islamic state that on the whole is much bigger, maybe territory than in terms of numbers of terrorists and groups than even Raqqa, comparably. So, you know, the Syrian government's dealing with all of that. They've got some help from the Russians. They've got a little bit of help from Iran, from Hezbollah, a little bit help from Iraq. But overall, you know, they're really taking it full on so many levels, and socially, economically. The economic siege of this country is probably the most devastating of all. The military fronts can be fought and can be, to various degrees of success you can achieve on a military level. You can drag on the results and you can do countermeasures and so forth. Economically, you can't. Economically, the thing that's driving this conflict is sanctions imposed by the United States, by Britain, by Western countries. We can talk about the gun running from the U.S., a coalition from Saudi Arabia, from Qatar, all the money laundering through all the various so-called NGOs, which we'll talk about later. But on the economic level, the thing that's driving the recruitment of extremism is definitely economic sanctions. The thing that's costing lives is economic sanctions. The thing that's really devastating this country on so many levels is this.
And with that, Patrick seems to have
sanctions.
Are you back, Patrick?
Are you back?
Good stuff.
I've got you.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, look, let's just run through a couple of other video clips that you've sent us, and just describe what we're looking at here.
Okay, this is a crater. This is out front of the al-Nusra headquarters, which is 20 meters from the White Helmets headquarters. So you have four school buildings, one school complex divided between al-Nusra and the White Helmets. This is a crater from an airstrike. It could be from something else, I'm not sure. But this was used, I believe, in a White Helmets propaganda video saying that the regime or the Syrian government was targeting a White Helmets facility. From what I gathered from locals. Okay, so, but this is al-Nusra's forecourt. I'm looking right there at the al-Nusra headquarters. The identical building is right behind it, was the White Helmet Center. Okay, and in the White Helmet Center, we could show you a lot more videos, al-Nusra flags everywhere. Jihadi slogans, extremism everywhere. So what we see with the White Helmets is this definite, it's a definite takfiri theme running through, you know, the organization. If you go to their centers, we visited three or four in East Aleppo, all the same. You know,
and
so
was this an example of one?
There's one of our guides there holding up there. That's the center right behind right in the back. You can see the Free Syrian Army, so-called, you know, revolution flag up there. Behind that, you'll see an al-Nusra flag on the wall inside. But that's the White Helmets so-called center there in Hanano. And there's a shoe. We're just doing a little pastiche of a BBC documentary style there.
Yeah, but
showing
this
shoe.
Very much reminded us of Saving Syria's Children.
Yes, that's all you need is to get the shoe shot in, and it's good to go for the Beeb. You know, incredible, absolutely incredible. Oh, and they weren't short of any supplies, by the way. So while sanctions were devastating hospitals and medical clinics still to this day, they have enough medical supplies in all of these so-called rebel-held hospitals for 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
And food supplies that's been hoarded from international food aid. I mean, unbelievable the amount of stuff that was hoarded in the so-called rebel or the in actuality terrorist held East Aleppo.
Well, Patrick, that was a fantastic segue to bring in Matthew Rycroft at this point, because he was speaking in the UN Security Council a day or two ago. They published his speech yesterday. So he made a statement to the UN Security Council, and he began by saying, "I want to begin by wholeheartedly condemning the terrorist attack on desperate civilians as they were evacuated as part of the Four Towns Agreement. This is the Rashdeen bus bombing, of course. It is utterly tragic that over 120 people, including a very high number of children, were brutally killed. The United Kingdom condemns this terrible attack. We will work to ensure whoever is responsible is held to account. I wish to salute the unity and bravery of the humanitarian response, including the response of the White Helmets. This is spectacular, Patrick, that he continues to push this forward, this idea that the White Helmets are first responders, humanitarian first responders. And yet, as you and I and Vanessa and many others have pointed out, you know, the £40 to £60 million that the UK government has given to the White Helmets so far has come in the form of non-humanitarian aid. So if this is a humanitarian organisation, why are they receiving non-humanitarian aid money?
Yes, that's a good question. But, you know, you can't tell me this is a humanitarian organization. We have in our possession over 50 images of different White Helmets in combat with terrorist organizations. I've posted those, by the way, on 21st Century Wire. But that's only a small fraction, I'll tell you right now, of the members that cross over. So if it was just one or two, fine. But we're talking, you know, dozens and dozens, and of what we maybe a couple of hundred that we don't even know about yet. And we're still sifting through social media accounts of members and terrorist organizations. So, you know, for someone to say, for a British ambassador, any ambassador, quite frankly, to say this is a humanitarian organization is just flat out laughable. And when you've actually gone and inspected their premises, it's just beyond, you know, a doubt that they are absolutely one and the same, working in tandem with terrorists. Not only that, we've also had, you know, residents that we spoke to, and they've said the same thing. It's been echoed many, many times by many different residents, which popping up randomly and speaking to people, and this is what they're telling us. So, yeah.
Well, just before we bring Alex in, I just want to go on with what Ryecroft was saying here, because he went on to say that these attacks once again bring into laser focus the urgent and desperate humanitarian needs of 13 million people in Syria. He was concerned by the difficulty in reaching these people because they're living under siege. It's very, very difficult. And of course, what he's suggesting is that the siege is, these people are living under siege conditions caused by the Syrian government. This is not the case at all. The sieges are being held in most cases by the terrorists. He said that at the International Syria Support Group meeting on the 20th of April, Russia committed to press the regime to allow the United Nations and its humanitarian partners to access Douma, one part of Eastern Ghouta. What is the situation 1 week later? The regime has not acted. There is no convoy. We owe it to the people of Douma to do everything we can to improve the situation. The UN has received the requisite assurances from the relevant armed opposition groups to allow them to deliver assistance to Douma, and it has identified a safe route to enter. The only thing that's lacking now is for the Assad regime to issue a facilitation letter and to pause its aerial bombardment of the area for long enough for the United Nations and humanitarian partners to enter. If Russia is able to ensure that the regime allows access, we call on the Security Council to act to ensure that the UN is able to deliver urgent supplies to Douma in the first instance. What he is calling here, he described them as opposition, armed opposition. what we're talking about here is Jaish al-Islam. This is a designated terrorist organization, designated so by Syria, Russia, Iran, and Egypt, not designated as terrorists by the UK or the US. So what he's talking about and what you've just highlighted, Patrick, is the fact that in most cases, it's the terrorist groups, including the White Helmets, which hold the food and the medical supplies, and they withhold the food and the medical supplies from the civilian populations in those areas, or they try to sell it to them for vastly inflated prices. So
it's not just that, Mike. You can get all the supplies you want, all the food you want, so if you pledge your allegiance to whatever terrorist group is in control of that area. This is something we heard time and time again from different residents. Okay, but what they're proposing here is just a repeat of Aleppo. They're trying to extend the same policy of claiming to set up humanitarian corridors, and the regime won't allow us in. These are hardcore, violent, religious extremist terrorists who are in control. And if you look at Eastern Ghouta, what did they do this week? They started fighting amongst each other, and at least 40 of them were killed because they were arguing over control of whatever black market is. I mean, this is like organized crime, armed gangs, religious extremists taking over whole parts of cities. Imagine if that happened in London. Okay, how would the government be dealing with it? Would they be calling to the international community to come in and open up a safe corridor to allow supplies in? Or would they just be going hell for leather to basically wipe these people out of parts of London? You know, that's exactly what the Syrian government is trying to do. It's also a safety issue. They've got residents and safe people in there, and they're trying very hard to allow to get people out who want to get out, and terrorists are keeping people from getting out in some cases. We saw this absolutely in Aleppo, and I would assume the same thing is happening in parts of Damascus. We spoke to residents who are being threatened over the phone, like, you know, we're taking, we've got all your goods, we've got your property or whatever, we've got your family, holding people to ransom. This is normal, par for the course, okay? And threats being made. This is just criminal, Mike. These aren't armed opposition. These aren't opposition. This is not political opposition. For anyone to be characterizing it in this way, whether they're an ambassador of Britain, U.S., France, or whatever, is ludicrous. Okay, and it just flies in the face of the facts. Okay.
So, Pat, when Rycroft then says we call on the Security Council to act to ensure the UN is able to deliver urgent supplies to Douma, what he's actually saying is, we are really keen to get urgent supplies into an area held by terrorists where we know full well that there is going to be this kind of the kind of activity, this kind of control that you've just described. So he's talking about providing supplies to terrorists.
Supplies, any supplies is going to help them. And in Aleppo, it's been proven they were supplying, some of these supplies had arms into these deliveries, okay? That came through charity organizations and people like this, okay, various and sundry, okay. And so what the whole Rushdie bombing, in my opinion, and Vanessa would probably agree with me on part of this, is there was a sectarian aspect to it in order to intensify the sectarian divides. But the real international agenda of the Rushdie bombing was to create the impression that the Syrian government can no longer be trusted, or the Russians can't be trusted with transfer evacuations and so forth, and we need blue helmets in their international forces. Okay, that was that. To me, this is what the motivation was. And we spoke to the real Syrian civil defense, and watching them work, okay, they don't go out with cameras filming when they go to a 911 call, okay? They go out to do the job. But what were they doing with cameras at the Rushdie bombing as the bombs went off, videoing the kids, videoing the slaughter? This is a giant PR. It's a disgusting snuff film PR operation. You can't describe it any other way. This is just, it's subhuman. And for them to be given political oxygen from any of these countries in the West is shameful. Okay, these were terrorists who carried it out. These are some of these terrorists are working in conjunction with Western intelligence agencies, with militaries, with NATO member countries like Turkey. OK, so, you know, we have a huge problem here. Well, we should have a problem here. But if you listen to our political leaders, there's no problem. It's all fine. It's great. You know, they're rebels. They're opposition. Let's we need them to come in and a transition in Syria, a political transition. Is just ridiculous. Okay. Yeah. So and people got to wake up and look at this for what it is.
Patrick, if I may, just a very, very quick question, and that is, how do the Syrian people sort of view the UK and the US? Are Syrian people becoming aware of the fact that there is dissent in UK? We UK column, many other people see through the propaganda of the British government. Do people on the ground in Syria realise that people are starting to fight back against this utter nonsense.
I don't know if they realize any level of dissent, but what I can tell you is that from even from the most rural area and being received as a foreigner and, you know, as an American, not a popular introduction at the moment, especially after the Tomahawk cruise missile strike a few weeks ago. But they've clearly can delineate the average Syrian between a person from America and Britain and France and the governments of America and Britain and France. So they can delineate between the population and the governments. And they actually go out of their way to tell you that. I can't tell you how many times that's happened. So listen, the people here know exactly what's happened. They know what's gone down. They know how it's gone down. They know who was involved with what, okay? They have the data. They have the information. They have lists of products of everything that's been smuggled into the country from Turkey and from which country, okay? They know all this. They know where the weapons are coming from, where the cash is coming from. And they know they've been bamboozled, okay? They have a high level of awareness of the causes of this crisis, which they call it a crisis. We call it a civil war in the West, which is inaccurate, okay? But the problem is, Mike and Brian, isn't with the Syrian people. The problem is the people in the West, on the whole, have no idea what's happened, except for your readers, you know, your viewers know, mine know, and some alternative media outlets know, and a few people in the mainstream are starting to come around. But on the whole, the problem is the people in the West are brainwashed by the major media outlets like CNN, like the BBC, like the Washington Post, like the Times, like the New York Times. They've done a fantastic job of brainwashing the population about every single fact about this conflict for the last 6 years. And this is the reason why this conflict has dragged on. This has provided the political impetus to get away with more fraud and more deception, as we saw with all these various chemical weapons events. Okay, this is just one small example of things that have been used to prolong the meddling by the West in to destroy this country and to destabilize this region. Okay, so the problem isn't with the Syrian people; it's definitely with the people in the West, and I blame the media for this. And I blame politicians because they're lazy and they don't really care enough to go and find out what's really going on. They just take what they see on the Today program at face value and go with the talking point, basically. Yeah. So,
okay. Thank you for that.
Well, which again brings us perfectly into the next one, because Alex, Peter Ford continuing to be attacked.
He is, Mike. Just before I forget the couple of points I had regarding Pat, I will mention them first. First of all, he mentioned that in the Eastern Ghouta, the rebel-held suburbs of Eastern Damascus, the terrorists have started having at each other last week. And this reminded me of Mark chapter 3 and verse 26. And if Satan rise up against himself and be divided, he cannot stand, but hath an end. So there's some hope in that, I think. We heard from Pat there about the UK permanent representative to the UN, one of the P5 ambassadors, certainly the fifth most trustworthy of them. Someone in the chat room suggesting his name would be better as Matthew Lycraft. But he's not the only green one on the permanent five. Here's Ambassador Nikki Haley. Again, not her birth name, but that's her Americanized name she's gone by. And here she is, and this photo was tweeted out by the US Embassy Syria account less than a week ago, 6 days. And there she is standing alongside Ra'id al-Saleh, who is the head of the White Helmets. Patrick's just told us that they have their headquarters 20 yards from the al-Nusra Front terrorist organization headquarters in Aleppo. And the tweet is captioned, Ambassador Nikki Haley met with Ra'id al-Saleh, head of Syria Civil Defense, as they call themselves wrongly, and she discussed continued US support for the White Helmets.
Well, so Alex, that is because I hadn't seen that, but Ra'id Saleh was meeting Matthew Lycraft last week as well, and I find this particularly interesting. As I've said in the latest article on the UK column website, we are at risk, I think, of military intervention in Syria over the coming 4 weeks, while there is no parliament to stop it. And I think I do wonder whether those two meetings with Ra'id Saleh may be related to that. I don't know if you've any thoughts.
Well, they're clearly not related to humanitarian aid, Mike, because this was busted months ago, and it's now a monthly, weekly, sometimes daily talking point by Maria Zakharova, the Russian Foreign Ministry's spokeswoman, who points out that the White Helmets are a bogus humanitarian organisation composed of particularly soldiers chosen for their handsomeness to appeal to middle-aged females in the West, basically. That's the sad truth of it. So it can't be a sincere attempt to talk humanitarian. It has to be, how can we get more stuff into your boys via this smuggling channel? I will talk about Peter Ford in a moment, but again, before I forget, something that particularly upset me and my wife more particularly, as she's a radiographer, in listening to Patrick Henningsen's excellent interviews on the Sunday Wire, the 21st Century Wire's three-hour special. The last two of them have come live from Syria. You must listen. The latter of them contains an interview with quite a sterling Syrian Catholic chap who is a businessman in Aleppo who had his factory trashed like all the rest by the Turks in Aleppo. But he's also a radiologist. And he says that Al Kindi Hospital, well known for being the best cancer hospital in the Middle East, the first in the whole of the Middle East to get a PET scanner, positron scanner, the most advanced scanner there is for cancer treatment, that was blown up by, if I'm not mistaken, al-Nusra again in Aleppo by men shouting Allahu Akbar. These are the moderate rebels whom Rycroft and Haley tell us that the Western governments need to support, and the Dutch government here too does its bit. And then because that was being blown up rather than commandeered, when the terrorists started sustaining nasty injuries, what happened was the Turks, or ultimately someone else through Turkey, smuggled in an entire computerized tomography scanner on the back of a lorry into Aleppo. Patrick must intervene and correct me if I'm wrong about this. But that's just astonishing that the Middle East's first specialist scanner of the new generation for cancer patients and other injuries was blown up. And then a new one was provided privately by the Western Turkey, but only for the terrorists. Patrick must correct me if I'm wrong there.
Right, no, yeah, sorry.
Correct. You're pretty much correct, Alex. That's pretty accurate.
Okay, right. Look, Alex, we need to start moving through some of these. So tell us what the latest is on Peter Ford.
Well, if you look up this Telegraph hit piece revealed how Britain's former Syria ambassador appeared on BBC to defend Assad after quietly taking a job with dictator's father-in-law. I've been in touch with Peter Ford about the many inaccuracies in this. The piece is primarily written, the first accredited author is by Robert Verkaik, who is at least linked with the neoconservative Gatestone Institute. He may not have been employed by them, but his name is on the website's list of authors. So he's got a clear interest in showing up or undermining comment on Syria, which isn't in accord with the UK and US government's attempts. It appears that the consortium first wanted to go to the Sunday Times because they were sniffing around this non-story weeks before the Telegraph. So there was a coordinated attempt to get him with it. The article leaves hanging whether Mr. Ford is paid or not, and Mr. Ford has confirmed that he is not paid for his membership of the British Syria Society. And as for the links with Dr. Akhras, who is the father of the Syrian First Lady, he says that I'm only a director, and at least I think the first iteration of this Telegraph article wrongly reported that he was the director. Peter Ford was supposedly the director of the British Syrian Society. The BSS is by any means almost defunct because all the other former ambassadors and the like have pulled out of the board of directors. And Peter Ford's given me a description of what he thinks of the article. He says it is untrue, tendentious, misleading, and just plain wrong. A case study in an ad hominem smear designed to smother discussion of actual facts. And he also contests the claim that he was unavailable for comment by the Telegraph. He says, no, the Telegraph made no attempt to contact me. And they also got his age wrong by 10 years.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's look at somebody else who we featured on the UK column, who's currently under massive attack in the media in Europe, also by Kenneth Roth from Human Rights Watch. Dispute propaganda, says Kenneth Roth. The hypocrisy there, I can't even begin to comment on. There used to be GONGOs, government-organised NGOs. Now there are alternative NGOs. This is Marcello Ferrada Donnelly, who is from Swedish Doctors for Human Rights. We interviewed him a couple of weeks ago. He's also appeared on RT, as you can see from the screenshot that Kenneth Roth has chosen to include there. And, of course, what was he focusing on? He was focusing on the disgraceful treatment of babies and children, and particularly one baby in a White Helmets so-called field hospital. where the baby was having a huge injection into the heart, and that clearly, if it didn't kill that child, the child was already dead when that happened. So this was, again, the use of people injured or killed in Syria, the use of them by the White Helmets for propaganda purposes. If you want to have a look at the interview that we had with Marcello, get onto the White Helmets section of the UK Column website. And if you scroll halfway down the page, there are several videos there. And you can see that. That's UK Column News from the 8th of March 2017. So do have a look at that.
Okay. Well, Patrick, you mentioned the fact that a lot of MPs, it must be the same in the American Senate as well, simply don't know what's happening because they follow the propaganda. We'd like to thank the lady who alerted us to this. It's a report which has come through the House of Commons Library, Syria and Iraq since the cruise missile attacks. This was published on Tuesday, May the 2nd, 2017. And I had a look at this. So on the website that we're showing on screen, this is simply a summary. The real document is this one. And I was absolutely fascinated to read this document written by a man called Ben Smith. And we'll come on to Mr. Smith in a moment. But what do they say about these briefing papers? Well, let's get to the important thing. This is an impartial briefing and evidence base. It's talking about evidence, apparently, and it's impartial. And then it goes on to say it is correct at the time of publication. So this is just one excerpt from it. This is well on in the report, about two thirds of the way through. Outlook. And what does it say? Does the cruise missile attack make a negotiated settlement more or less likely? The Syrian government may abstain from using any more chemical weapons. Now, what's interesting is if you go through the document, it uses a lot of references. When I checked out the references, they're NGOs, they're very modest little web-based organisations such as the Syrian Observatory, their BBC reports, their CNN reports. So this is supposed to be a factual, unbiased document written by a gentleman called Ben Smith. But when we get into it, absolutely no evidence whatsoever, forensic factual evidence, about the Syrian government actually using chemical weapons. So the whole of this briefing for parliamentarians based on a lie. And I'll just bring in here, who is Ben Smith? Because if you attempt to find him, you can see him listed here in the House of Commons staff into international affairs and defence. And he's right at the end of that line. Who is this man? What is his experience to be doing so-called deep analysis on Syria? From what I've seen of this document, this is created. This is like weapons of mass destruction, Mike. This is carefully crafted propaganda, totally biased for British MPs.
Well, Brian, we've got some good news because UNESCO is joining forces with Cartoon Peace on Twitter to promote press freedom and freedom of expression. I thought that was fantastic. I wondered why might they be doing that today. Well, of course, this is May the 3rd, and we should all realise that this is International Press Freedom Day. World Press Freedom Day 2017 is today. This is fantastic stuff. They say that critical minds for critical times, the media's role in advancing peaceful, just and inclusive societies on every year, 3rd of May is a date that celebrates the fundamental principles of press freedom to evaluate press freedom across the world and defend press, the media from attacks on their independence. Fantastic. We must be hugely impressed by the by UNESCO's efforts here. Well, let's look at how well Britain is doing with regard to press freedom, because last week Reporters Without Borders released their 2017 rankings for press freedom. And unfortunately, Britain has moved down the list once again. This is a result of the Investigatory Powers Act and other things like that. So they've dropped two places. So let's see who we got there. I can't actually quite see, but people on screen will be able to see. Britain has now moved down to number 40. The United States is number 43. So we have fallen behind France for press freedom. We've actually dropped 10 places on this in the last 4 years. We're now behind France, Chile and South Africa, amongst others. Ireland has dropped five places to 14th. And the United States, well, its press, as I guess, is completely controlled at this stage. Patrick, you know, just briefly, because we are short of time here, the situation with the press with regard to Syrian reporting, we can tell. I mean, it's there's no evidence required because they demonstrated every time they put pen to paper. The press reporting on Syria utterly controlled, so there is no freedom of the press with regard to Syrian reporting, as just one example.
Yeah, you can argue about why, you know, what are the levers of control in the British, the American, the Canadian, you know, the NATO member state press. But really, a lot of it comes down to, yes, you know, there are sort of people controlling editorial positions and so forth. That's been proven throughout history. But a lot of it's self-censorship. And I'm just going to say this, okay? Everything that we've seen and that we everywhere we've gone over the last couple of weeks, you know, every single mainstream journalist could have had access to that. All they have to do is show up and ask for it, okay? But they're not here. This place should be teeming with reporters, Mike, Brian, okay? They should be. I should be running into CNN, Time Magazine. I ran into one Daily Mail reporter, okay? He was here. And I ran into someone who claimed they were with the Washington Post, okay? And that's it. But if you go to Beirut, you're bumping into them everywhere. Or if you go to Istanbul, you're bumping into them everywhere. They're all over the place. They're not here. And the reason they're not here is because they don't want to be here. They don't want to report the facts. They don't want to learn what's really gone on. Because it's a war zone, there is a level of public safety that has to be adhered to and respected in terms of the operations that are going on security-wise, and B, just for the safety of the media itself. So they're all screaming and crying that there's a press block here, or that Western media aren't allowed here, which is a complete lie. Okay. And by the way, you know, with the amount of press control in the West, in Britain, in the U.S. and so forth, the amount of self-censorship and all that, you know, it's just a small wonder that, you know, we claim to have all these freedoms in the West, but we are, you know, in a lot of ways self-policing, because people, for whatever reason, they don't want to get the facts, because the facts run counter to the narrative. And the narratives have all been decided by Boris Johnson and everybody down the food chain in Britain, and in the same in America, from Trump all the way down the food chain. They already have the narrative. So anything that runs counter to the narrative gets discarded automatically. And so you can see this reflected right across the media coverage.
Yes.
Okay. People should be up in arms about this. They should be upset. The public in the West should say, why are we being screwed? Why are we being screwed at every turn by all these media organizations who are lying to us? And then politicians are just reflecting those lies back onto the people, and then thus giving them legitimacy. So this is a laundering. This is laundering narratives and lies and propaganda is being laundered through what are respectable media outlets and institutions and academia. And then they come through the mouths of politicians, and the average person on the street doesn't know any better. They're none the wiser, because it's been laundered through all these supposedly respected institutions. But when you go back and look, like the Ben Smith statement that you've so rightly pointed out there, that it's completely biased, total supposition, no evidence at all. It's like non-evidence-based commentary. Right. And that is what's running our policy and running our agenda. We've got a huge problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And in Holland, it's no better, it seems, Alex, because forget about self-censorship. Now, we seem to have allegations that the police are bribing newspapers to be quiet.
Yes, not just any papers, but the Telegraaf, the biggest in the country. The chap on screen is the surprisingly young-looking chief of the National Police, Eric Akerboom. He looks like he's slightly of a similar mould to some of our policemen, just looking at the eyes and the posture there. Also the behaviour, because I have here his statement when he was rumbled, and it's all full of claims that we misestimated our own data. There was no intent to mislead or silence the Telegraaf. But what it's about is the Telegraaf asked the police, could you give us details, please, on how many people came in as bogus asylum seekers who then committed crimes? And the police said, improperly, by the way, this was on the basis of a Freedom of Information Act request. They said, no, we absolutely don't link asylum seeker databases with police logs. That's racist, and we don't do it. The Telegraph then said, no, we've got wind of the fact that a special unit has been set up just to do that, so we've rumbled you. And the police said, well, if you shut up about that, we'll give you a special interview with the chief of police, Eric Akerbohm, in which he will rave about everything we're doing to squash pickpockets from designated safe countries. And we'll also give you specially privileged stats on rejected asylum seekers who refuse to leave the country. In other words, in European countries, this is information which papers can get if they're very sweet with the establishment. It's even if you put in a Freedom of Information request, you will not be given it.
Okay, well, thanks for that, Alex. And just to round off this media section, I'd just like to point out that Patrick Henningsen and Vanessa Bealey, along with several others, are going to be speaking in Frome on Sunday the 11th of June at 7 p.m. That's in the Cheese and Grain in Frome. We will be publicising this over the next couple of weeks. Look forward to that. We better quickly move on. Alex, what is going on here with Theresa May and Juncker, and particularly this article from, Frankfurter Allgemeine?
Yes, this is the Dutch, sorry, the German paper of record, the FAZ, the Frankfurter Allgemeine, and this is how long this report is, actually. If you look at the printout, there's a full page there, and there, and there, and there. It's four pages of close type here, or filling a huge spread in the Sunday edition. It's a complete leak of Juncker's team's account, deliberately, because they're going to be doing this every stage of the way now in the Brexit negotiations, the continental side are, a leak of exactly what went on when Juncker came to have dinner with Theresa May. Now, I've discussed this with you and Brian, and you'll have your own thoughts. But it's been summarised in 30 tweets by, I think, the Berlin chief of The Economist, or the former Berlin chief of The Economist, very usefully. It's astonishing what went on. Mrs. May turns out basically to have known nothing, to have not been briefed. And I think, Brian, and you may have for the same view as me, which is that she's been regarded by the civil service and maybe even by David Davis, who's, I would say, a fake Brexiteer, as basically unable to process the information, or don't bother her with the information. So when Juncker actually said and pulled out of his briefcase, the huge dossiers for Croatian accession and one other of the dossiers, he plonked them on the table and said, look, Theresa, you're not going to get a deal in a jiffy, and you're not going to wrap up the issue of EU nationals in Britain and UK citizens on the continent in time for the June summit, as you were suggesting. He said, not only have you got your election in the way, but look at the thick wads here. This takes eons to negotiate. And her face fell, and she said, but I thought we could make a clean success of Brexit. And it dawned on Juncker at this point that she was really not up to the task and had not been briefed. Any thoughts?
Well, I certainly have got some thoughts, but perhaps I could explain that when we move on just through a little bit more. We'll bring it in now. Let's just have a look at this. This is Guardian picking up on the fact that when Theresa May went to Cornwall and Bristol, public were not allowed to get near her, were not allowed to interface with her. In fact, she was guarded by police, who protected her own activists from anybody in the public who was challenging, heckling. I had to put this little title in, Suffer the Little Children, because look at the age of the people in the publicity campaign. So let's get in a bit deeper. And this was just an incredible thing that popped up this morning. We had a look at Bloomberg here. This is part of a video. A big win would give her a mandate to push through her own brand of Brexit. Now we're getting to the truth of the matter, because whatever her brand of Brexit is, it's not reality. If she's naive enough to think she can actually achieve Brexit, we know that behind the scenes, Britain is being locked ever deeper into the EU, principally, of course, by EU military unification. But there's somebody in the shadows here, and we had missed this one completely, but let's bring it in today, because here is the man who is actually running Theresa May. And this is Jim Messina. Who is this man? Well, he was formerly Obama's deputy chief of staff. Around him, May's brought together Cameron's original election team. These are some of the other names. We're going to be looking into them. It's significant that last year Messina advised Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy, if I pronounce that correctly. So we're now seeing Obamaites who are actually running the Tories' election campaign. And this is the meat of it. The Huffington Post here, one of many organisations that picked up. This man is embedded in Common Purpose in the States. This was Common Purpose operating around Obama. And I have to say, of course, it was cpexposed.com that highlighted this back in 2009. So to answer your question there, Alex, we can now show that we have got neocons and Obamaites running the British Conservative election campaign based on Common Purpose.
Yeah, Common Purpose right at the centre. And so let's bring Common Purpose on screen, because at the moment they are running the Navigator course in Qatar. And participants, they say, testing out their ideas with various people. And as you can see, it is typical
toys on the table,
Common Purpose course, completely screwing with people's minds. But what happened in the evening? Well, they all popped off to see the British ambassador in Qatar. There we go. There he is in the centre, Ajay Sharma. Thanks to him for hosting Common Purpose Navigator alumni at the British Embassy this evening, connecting and inspiring emerging leaders. So once again, we find Common Purpose right at the centre of the British government, no matter where they are in the world.
And I'm going to bring in here Qatar, extremely interesting, because Qatar is mentioned when we see extremism coming in through the mosques in UK. We have members of the Muslim community saying, well, we get a new mosque, we get a new imam, and who's funding this with the new radical Islam? Well, Qatar is always named together with Saudi.
So Common Purpose inspired, perhaps?
Common Purpose inspired would be our belief, but we can now say with confidence we've got Common Purpose at the heart of Theresa May's election campaign, using the sort of agitation that Saul Alinsky was, of course, so famous for, the very man around Hillary Clinton and Obama.
Absolutely. Well, let's bring this on then. This letter doing the rounds of the internet at the moment. This is from Roger Mullen, MP, who is SNP's Treasury spokesperson, and it's to the Chief Executive for Party and Election Finance of the Electoral Commission. It says, Dear Ms. Bennett, you will no doubt be aware that the annual general meeting of HSBC Holdings PLC was held on the 28th of April 2017 at Queen Elizabeth II Conference Centre in London. At this meeting, serious allegations were made about significant HSBC loans to the company IPGL, led by the former treasurer of the Conservative Party and current chair of the Conservative Party Foundation, Mr. Michael Spencer. The question and answers at the AGM are now fully in the public domain on YouTube. In essence, the allegation, which has not been refuted, was that HSBC loaned IPGL over £200 million from the 6th of October 2008 onwards. The company was in some financial distress. Despite this, it is reported that in excess of £5 million of HSBC loans have been laundered directly to Conservative Party headquarters. I'm therefore calling for an immediate investigation into the situation, and he lists four specific questions. Now, Alex, I'm fascinated by this, but I'm particularly fascinated about the timing of this. Now, some people might view that this is the scandal that has caused Theresa May to call the general election now, because she's hoping that if there's a new government in place, that perhaps this can all be brushed under the carpet. But the point is that this has been going on since 2008. So here we have the original Telegraph report saying that Michael Spencer had pledged Numis shares as security for the loan. And Numis was another company that he was chairman of alongside the fact that he owned IPGL. So there was some dodgy dealing going on here because shares were being used as collateral for a loan, but he did not declare that as he should have to the stock market. And here we have the Guardian a couple of days later saying Tory treasurer admits breaking loan rules. And what's interesting about this is that they also mention Carphone Warehouse co-founder David Ross, who admitted that he had also failed to disclose similar arrangements involving four separate firms, including Carphone Warehouse. And the point is that Ross was also a Tory donor, also a friend of David Cameron. So what we seem to find here is a pattern of behaviour amongst Tory donors, but this is going back to 2008 and 2009. So here we have the Telegraph again from April 2009. Tory Treasurer Michael Spencer seals the £200 million deal. So that's the £200 million loan from HSBC. So that's good. That has been announced publicly. And then from May 2009, Tory Treasurer, in shares tax probe. And what was this about? This was the same man again, this time HMRC querying what they described the tax base cost of LCAP share transferred to Dutch subsidiary Incap Netherlands BV in 2001 by Spencer's private investment company IPGL. So my point here, Alex, is that this stuff has been rumbling on for quite a number of years, and suddenly it's become an issue right now. Why? What's your reading of this? Why do you think this is happening at this time?
My reading of it, Mike, is that there's simply so many Tory scandals breaking simultaneously that everyone with a YouTube account seems to be saying, I'm confident that the general election has been foreshortened in order to cover up my particular scandal. And they might all be right. There's so much breaking together. There's a lot of it revolves around Tory funding, also Tory misuse of public funds in the don't get me wrong, I'm absolutely not a Labour supporter, and I think the current Labour team would be utterly disastrous, for which just see Diane Abbott's performance yesterday for one. But clearly the meat of the corruption at the moment is among the Conservative Party, because they're the natural party of government in the UK, particularly if Scotland is forced out of the Union. And there's been a generation of political scandal involving, you know, misuse of public funds for electioneering is the latest one that the police and the CPS are interested in. Cozy relationships with particularly HSBC, but the banking world in general, is another one that's breaking. And another is the whole line of what's been going on with mining and extractive industries and former Tory frontbenchers and peers' shareholdings therein. And perhaps to round that off, The chap whose tweets I referred to, who summarises the Frankfurter Allgemeine article, is in fact the current Berlin bureau chief of The Economist, Jeremy Cliff. And so he's quite well accomplished. And of his 30 tweets, which he tweeted out in the night of the 1st of May, the middle one, number 15, is key. He accurately translates here that May thought that what she could do was the following, a repeat of the following. As Home Secretary, May opted out of EU measures, playing to the UK audience, then opted back in to more than two thirds of them. This was the justice pillar. And wrongly thinks she can do the same with Brexit. And if I look at the German original of this, it says that May's argument to Juncker, which horrified all the Eurocrats, was at the time, das hängte niemand an die große Glocke. Nobody made a song and dance about Britain secretly signing up again to Europol and all the rest and the EAW. And so the paper goes on to say that May argued, I can do the same again now. Officially, I can go hard on Brexit, but in fact, I can use I can actually carry on with the EU in our own interests. Who is our? I think it's actually not the Conservative Party or the British government. I think it's a small number of financiers.
Yep, I think we could agree on that.
Well, we would agree with you on that. Now, we're very short of time, but we promised twice just to follow up on the IPCC story. I'll do this very, very quickly. Just to remind people, what we were interested in is that when the Hillsborough investigation was going on, IPCC investigated the Freemasons. Had there been secret meetings? Was evidence covered up? IPCC supposedly investigating Alison Hernandez, who's the Police and Crime Commissioner down here in Devon, but they don't want to investigate secret links between individuals connected with Common Purpose. Now, we have shown you some documentation. This was an invoice showing IPCC staff being trained by Common Purpose. And note the redacted information, so very secretive. We emailed them, say, would you like to answer some questions? Basically, back came a fob off. So we'd asked for a comment on the connections with Common Purpose. Their response says IPCC has no concerns in relation to the matter you've raised. We're satisfied there's no conflict of interest associated with any of the West Mercia officers involved in this managed investigation. This was a complete fob off. Common Purpose not mentioned in the response, and we directly asked for information about collaboration between Common Purpose and the IPCC. So we'd just like to tell our audience we've gone back to IPCC and asked them to simply answer the question. But this is very serious stuff, because we've shown in this news, as just one example, common purpose embedded in the elections, embedded in training of people overseas, working with British ambassadors. But when you ask, what are these people doing, even the supposedly independent Police Complaints Commission seems to be prepared to obfuscate or possibly lie as to their involvement. I think we better wrap up there. Patrick, 20 seconds of summary or comment from you to finish, please.
Well, first off, we'll probably get attacked, myself, Vanessa, for being an Assadist or a Putinist, and that we're being paid by the regime, whatever, to be here. Let me tell you that this is 100% self-funded from our pockets and from the help of some of our readers and listeners, okay? And it's costing, you know, it's quite an expensive endeavor. Let's put it that way, okay? And to have the security that's required and so forth, and the secure transport and all this sort of stuff, it's expensive, okay? So just to let you know, we do have a donations link on the site to help with the travel fund, and we do appreciate any support that anybody can give us as well. But where your tax money is going is here. Okay, this is a little booklet that we picked up in the White Helmet Center, you know, and so forth. You know, so these people are helping to prolong the conflict. They're bringing on airstrikes with their videos from the West. They're keeping this conflict going. They're also providing propaganda for terrorist groups throughout Syria and further afield. Okay, that's where our tax money is going. So if $200 million. For booklets, uniforms, and helmets, where's the rest of the money going? Could it, pray tell, be laundered for other more sort of illicit items, perhaps? Hundreds of millions of dollars have been funneled to this group, okay? And all we've got is a few uniforms and a few books.
Well, Patrick, we may be able to answer that question in the not-too-distant future. Alex, very quickly.
Speaking of Western taxpayer-funded terrorist training equipment, it's also come out this week, you can read about it in The Hill, that Soros, through his Open Society Foundation, got US aid and United States State Department money to have Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals translated into Macedonian. That's the book, which, of course, is dedicated to Lucifer and the overthrow of governments.
Okay, good stuff.
Okay, we will follow up, because we have so much today, but we need to end. I'll just say as a comment that the team up in Perth are running the Child Abuse Conference. That's all down to Andy Peacher and his team. And we learnt first thing this morning that two members of the Scottish Government have deemed to turn up. So this is going to be very interesting feedback straight from survivors into the heart of the Scottish Government. And also, tomorrow we will report on a gentleman called Ollie, who is being subjected to a virtual trial as a result of his protest about council tax. We've run out of time today, but we'll cover that tomorrow. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. Excellent reports, as always. Thank you, our audience and listeners, for joining UK Column. If you like what we're doing, what Patrick is doing with 21st Century Wire, please donate, because as Patrick says, we can only do what we do with your financial support. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.